We are continuing our look at the story of Joseph. I hope you find it to be an interesting story. It's one of my favorites in the Old Testament. It's a story, first of all, of forgiveness, and that's what we've titled it, because it's a story about someone who has horrible things done to him and yet gives out grace and is a channel for God's forgiveness in such a powerful way that he redeems a whole people. And it's a story of providence, that is, the idea that God has a plan and a purpose for our lives. And that's something that we're going to talk more about as we get into the story. But understand, all Christians believe that God has a plan and a purpose for us, but we differ on how much of our lives happen in accordance with that. In other words, how does free will play into God's plan? And this is a story that really talks in great detail about God using ways and means that seem at first crazy and haphazard and chaotic, and yet uses them to bring about good. So that'll be a theme we'll talk about later. It's also got lots of other themes. Themes about favoritism and revelation, about how God speaks to us. It's about sibling rivalry and hatred. It's got about sexual impropriety and why bad things happen to good people. And I tell folks there's also a lot of ambiguity in these stories. And what do I mean by that? I mean that we get sometimes the bare outline of a story, and then we kind of fill in the details. And I think sometimes we bring our own stories. I think we're encouraged to do that. I think that in talking through these stories, they actually come alive for us. You know, when I was a kid and I first started really reading the Bible by myself, I read it by myself all the time. I actually got it on tape. That shows how old I am. And I had a big, you remember those portable cassette players? I had one attached to my belt, and I remember it used up a set of batteries about every day. And I would listen to the New Testament, which you can listen to in a day, believe it or not, if you do nothing else. And so I would work listening to this thing and having it bang against my leg. It weighed about 5 pounds, 10 pounds, I don't know, it was heavy. And it'd smack against me all day. But I would do it by myself. And later on, when I began to teach, I realized how much I learned just from sharing the stories with other people. That's especially true of these stories in Genesis. You know, we find they come alive and they speak to us in a powerful way. Well, last week we talked about Joseph's family. Wow, it is a dysfunctional family. Lots and lots of problems and difficulties. Jacob, first of all, is not a nice guy. And he marries a woman he loves, Rachel, but he also has to, because of circumstances, marry her sister. Right now, that's a bad start. Two sisters, and he loves one and doesn't really care much about the other. And then they get into a competition with one another for his affection, but also to have children. And Leah, the wife he doesn't like, is having all these children, so she's winning. And Rachel is sorrowful, so they give him their handmaid. So now he has two more concubines here, and he has kids with all of them. And by the time this is all done, he has 12 sons and one daughter by four different women. And they're all living in the same house. That does not sound good, does it? All right, there's the richest, for a time there was a guy who was the richest man in the world. He was this emir in Kuwait or something. And he had a house, the largest house, private house in the world. It had 1,200 rooms. And then he got a second wife. And I love that story because his first wife would not allow the second wife to live in their house. 1,200 rooms. So he had to build her a separate house. And I thought, that makes sense. This story of all these people living together in the same house is a formula for disaster happening, right? And so there are all these siblings that carry on the rivalry between the wives, and they're fighting amongst one another, and it's just not going well. And then along comes Joseph, the favorite son of the favorite wife, okay? And the dad loves him, and he gives him this special coat, which we often think of as the coat of many colors, and that's one of the translations of the phrase there. Actually, the word, nobody knows how to translate it, so that's a good one. It could mean bejeweled. It could mean long-sleeved. Whatever the translation is, we know what it means, and it means this, that he's the favored son, so he's given special clothes to wear that indicate his superiority over his brothers and the fact that they are going to work for him. Okay, so a comparison would be to say a farmer has 12 sons. He gives 11 of them overalls, and he gives one of them a three-piece white suit. What does that tell you? Okay, that's the same thing here, and they all get the message. This young son, he's the 11th in the line, is favored over everybody. And he immediately begins to supervise the other brothers and gives bad reports about how lazy they are. This is going real well. And then he has dreams that he shares with everybody. Maybe he's naive, maybe he's arrogant, maybe he's stupid, but these dreams have the point of saying, I'm one day going to rule over all of you. And they all hear this message, and it makes them even more angry. And so in their anger, they decide to do something about it. And so Joseph goes to visit his brothers, and while he is there, they see him coming. They're 50 miles away from home, actually 65 miles away from home. They see him coming, and what do? They say, let's murder him. And one of the brothers, the oldest, Reuben, says, no, let's not kill him. That's a bad thing. Let's throw him into a cistern. So that's a pit that collects water. So when it rains, he'll drown, or an animal will get him, or something bad will happen. And while he's there, Reuben actually plans to rescue him. But while he's in the pit, they see some Ishmaelites or Midianites come by, and they sell him as a slave, something my brothers always joked they would do, but never did. Okay, and he is sold, and there's a picture of him being taken away to be sold into slavery. Now, that would be a horrible thing to have happen to you, right? Imagine yourself as Joseph. I'm also going to ask you to imagine yourself as these brothers. How would doing something this horrible impact your life? You're still living all together. You still got dad who believes, they all deceive him into believing that he has, that Joseph has been killed by wild animals. Okay, so they're living with a lie to their father. They're living under this pressure with one another. It's an interesting thing. But Joseph, he gets sold into slavery, and now he is living, and this is where we'll pick up. This is what the scripture says. Joseph was taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, brought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. So he's bought. It's hard for me to even get into my head that we could be owned by somebody. Although people feel owned, and gosh, I was just in prison yesterday, and you think in a sense everybody there has their lives very narrowly confined, and we can think of other slave-like conditions that people live in today. But certainly here, this is a tough thing to be. Joseph is sold as a slave. He's bought by an important official, the captain of the king's guard. We imagine a man of wealth. And so this is what happens there. The Lord was with Joseph, okay? And notice Lord's all in capital letters there. That's to let us know the word is Yahweh, the God who created everything, that special name for God. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man. And Joseph, we're going to see this over and over again in his life. You know, he has these terrible things happen, and I don't know if it's because he's cream, and he rises to the top automatically, or does he have such a positive attitude that no matter what happens, he's going to make the best of the bad situation? Maybe it's a combination of the two, but he certainly has a good attitude, or seemingly has one, because he continually, again, succeeds in whatever situation life finds him. I think it'd be easy to become bitter and do a horrible job, but here he rises to success. He became a successful man. He was in the house of his Egyptian master. So he's living there in the house, he's working, and he's so successful that he's given more and more responsibility, and he succeeds in everything he does. His master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hands. So success is coming. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him. He made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. Now that was fairly common in the ancient world for a master to have a servant, a slave that he entrusted with everything. And that's interesting to us because in a certain sense then this slave, is he a slave anymore if he's in charge of everything? Yes and no. I mean, he has a position of power and prominence here working for this great man that actually puts him in some ways is socially above some folks, but still he's a slave. From the time that made him overseer in this house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in house and field. So success is coming, everybody's happy, it's all going well. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge. And I think when I read that, is that a good thing? You know? We're going to see it doesn't work out too well for Joseph or Potiphar. But you wonder, if you have an employee, should you just make him do all the work and then just sit back? That's what it says here. He had no concern for anything but the food that he ate. So all he's doing is sitting back fat and happy. All right? And Joseph was handsome and good-looking. Now, I have six brothers, and people always, you know, my folks, if they had one fault as parents, they would label, you know, the smart one and the strong one and like that. Okay. And by the time I came along the eighth one, there wasn't much left, I can tell you that. So I always told everybody, but several of my other brothers did this too, I always told them I was the handsome one. Actually, that's not true. But, you know, none of us were that good looking. But is it a good thing to be looking? Everybody wants to be good looking, but being good looking can be a trap, right? Because people, what do? They look at you for how you look. And they might value as an object more than as a person and relating to you. Boy, I remember we were in Portland, and we had a gal in our youth group who was just stunningly beautiful. And Joey and I would talk, gee, is that a blessing or a curse? Because people see you then just as this object. You know, can you get beyond that? So he's good looking, and then we're going to find out that's going to be a problem for him in this situation. And we get a picture of him with Pharaoh here, and in the background is Potiphar, and in the background is Potiphar's wife, who, interestingly, is not named. We just call her Potiphar's wife. Okay? And after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." Now, this is one of those ambiguous situations where everybody starts filling in things. So if you see this in movies, often they portray Potiphar as really an old guy and his wife is really young, but all that, we don't know. We don't know if she does this all the time. We don't know if this is a one-time situation. We don't know anything about it other than that she desires Joseph. So lie with me. And is it a desire coming from desire or is it power? You know, it's hard to tell, isn't it? Because she could be doing this to watch him squirm or to put him in an uncomfortable position. Or maybe she's jealous of him and is now putting him under her control or exercising her authority over him. Lots of things going on here. Certainly this is coming from her position of power. And we learn here right away that sexual harassment and the Me Too movement is nothing new. It's been going on since the dawn of time. But he refused, and he said to his master's wife, "Look, with me here, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my hand." So his argument is basically, I've been well treated. This would be an insult to my master, the one who owes me, so I can't do this. All right, and he says, "He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" So he sees this as an offense against his master, and he sees it as a sin against God, something that would violate the way that God has called on him to live. And although she spoke to Joseph day after day, so this is something you get, wow, what is Joseph supposed to do? Day after day, she's after him, hounding him, harassing him. And he would not consent to lie beside her or to be with her. What should Joseph do in this situation? You know, what are his options? Probably very limited in his society. He has to deal with this woman who's pressuring him, but he doesn't have any good options on what to do. And one day, however, when he went into the house to do his work, and while no one else was there in the house, so he's there alone with her, she caught hold of his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. And when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called out to the members of her household and said to them, "See, my husband has brought among us a Hebrew to insult us. He came into me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice." So her solution to this is, this insult of him refusing to lie with her, is that she blames the victim, which is something oppressors do, something that people who sexually harass folks do, blame the victim. And notice what she says here, he's a Hebrew. Slavery in the ancient world was not based on skin color at all. It was sometimes based on the nationality or citizenship of someone. So she's saying he's not an Egyptian. He's not one of us. He's a slave, and he's not one of us. And when he heard me raise my voice and cry out, he left his garment beside me and fled outside. Then she kept his garment by her until his master came home. So the cloak becomes the symbol of his guilt. And she told him that same story, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you have brought among us came into me to insult me. But as soon as I raised my voice and cried out, he left his garment beside me and fled outside." When his master heard the words that his wife had spoken to him, saying, "This is the way your servant treated me," he became angered. Okay, so he's super upset about this. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. He remained there in prison. Now, in the ancient world, most people weren't imprisoned, right? Why would you go to prison? Well, most punishments were physical, corporal, or, you know, exile, you know, shoved or shunned out of the community. But the wealthiest people would have prison for the people that offended them. The chance of redemption was always there to some degree. And it was actually considered a worse punishment than death in many ways. You ever see, have you ever read The Count of Monte Cristo? No? What a shame. Great book. It's got about 400 pages of how horrible it would be to be in prison back then, right? It's actually taking place in the 1700s, but it's just terrible. You know, this darkness, no information, food comes in, you know, poverty. It's a bad situation. So he's living in the worst of conditions, and he remained there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love. He gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. And the chief jailer committed to Joseph's care all the prisoners who were in the prison, and whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The chief jailer paid no heed to anything that was in Joseph's care because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. And it sounds like the same thing, right? Even in prison, even in this dank, dark place, he rises to the top and is successful. So let's talk about some of the things that are here in this story. First of all, let's talk about Joseph's attitude. It's amazing, isn't it, how successful this guy is everywhere. And we're going to talk more about this later, but he is somebody who constantly succeeds in things. He is someone who cannot be stopped. And we admire his attitude, and we seek to prosper just as he did. The next thing I want to lift up with is how uncomfortable many of us are with this story. I have had many people tell me, gee, I don't know why things like this are in the Bible. But I'm going to ask you, why are things like this in the Bible? Because things like this happen, right? And I will tell you, I am glad that this story, and even if others like this that sometimes make us feel uncomfortable, are there, because they name a problem and give us a religious context to talk about it. So this is an opportunity for us to talk about sexual harassment and abuse, certainly a problem in our society, certainly a problem to many people who have hurts and injuries. It gives us a chance to name it and to talk about it and to deal with it, not only in a religious context, but positively. It's certainly an issue that we have to look at and to deal with. Abuse and power positions used to do wrong invites us to discuss. And, of course, this whole issue of sexual harassment and abuse. You know, we live in an age where there's the Harvey Weinsteins and the Me Too movement. And again, we're reminded here that nothing here is new, but we're also reminded that it's something we in the church and we as society should not tolerate. When I was in seminary, they kind of looked down on this story because they said, well, it's a male story. It's about a man getting abused. There are certainly stories in the Bible about females being abused. The rape of Tamar stands out, and we've talked about that in our worship before. But I kind of think it's a good thing there's a story about a man, too. I think, as a man, it helps me imagine myself in this situation a little more easily, which I think maybe helps me to be more sensitive to the issue. But also, it makes us aware that abuse and harassment can happen in a variety of different contexts and ways. So I think that's important. And it reminds us that power and position are really the key behind a lot of abuse that takes place. You know, one of the realities is, too, the church has had terrible problems with this in the last few decades. When I came into ministry, we were really just for the first time beginning to deal with sexual abuse by clergy. You know, that was in the 80s, right? And I remember it vividly because we'd have ministerial meetings and we would talk about this. And when I first came into ministry in 1983, there were several district superintendents who said, well, if somebody came to you and told you about sexual abuse of a minor, and they told you that confidentiality was the most important thing, and I said, no, you know, we've got to deal with it. If it's to a minor, we have to confront them. We have to make it known. We have to deal with that. You know, that's now become the standard of position, but I could tell you it was an argument there at first. We in the church today recognize that sexual abuse is possible, so we do things to protect children and vulnerable adults, where we have our safe sanctuary policy of having, you know, two adults working with children. So we're doing our best to create healthy boundaries and a safe place for our children and youth and vulnerable adults to be. But that's important for us to recognize that there's a need for that because of human sin. And we believe in sin, right? That's something we acknowledge and recognize. So healthy boundaries are important. I'm going to tell you that one of the things people get from this story that I kind of agree with and kind of don't is they say this. They say, flee sexual immorality. In fact, if you were going to look up this on the internet and talk about sermons, that would be the number one thing people would say about it. I'd say that's a good general principle, to flee sexual immorality. But I'd also say it's kind of misnames what's going on here. It isn't so much temptation that he's running away from here as it is power and harassment and abuse. And I will tell you that even though he flees, does that work out real well for him? I mean, he gets thrown into prison for it. There are consequences that he still pays for it, even though I think it was the right thing for him to do. I'll tell you, too, that fleeing sexual immorality, there's a danger in making that the message here. Why? Because let's change the story a little bit. Let's say Joseph is a woman instead of a man. Let's say that Potiphar's wife is Potiphar rather than his wife. And then you go, could Joseph in that scenario flee? No. He would be a victim then, right? And here's where I'm coming from in this. Sometimes when people encounter folks who have gone through sexual abuse, they almost say, why didn't you flee? You know, why didn't you flee immorality when that really wasn't an option or possible? So we need to hear that. Sometimes we end up blaming the victim in the situation. And that's really kind of like something I wrestle with a lot, because I think part of what we need to do as people who are healthy and strong in our faith is to help create healthy boundaries and places, decisions that we'll deal with in positive ways. Joseph had the option to flee, and I think that was wise for him to do it. You know, when the Me Too movement came out, and I'm going to say something here that might get me in trouble. I hope not. I hope it's just thought-provoking, and I'll deal with it in several different ways. But one of the things we heard was about women, especially who were dealing with Weinstein or with Fox News or with Matt Lauer. And part of the issue was these men would get them alone and kind of threaten their careers, you know. And I was going, huh. I know your career is important, but and it's certainly wrong of those men to do that, absolutely wrong. But wouldn't you go, hey, it's my career, it's a job? I don't know. I would hope people would do that, and that's as far as I'm going there, because I also recognize sometimes we blame the victim, and they were victims in this situation, put in difficult, if not impossible, situations. And blaming the victims compounds the crime, right? That's something society has done. Blame the person who was, you know, helpless in a situation. We certainly don't want to do that. On the other hand, I want to urge us to be careful and to set up healthy boundaries. And I'll tell you, blaming the victim is something we talked about a lot in my family when I was growing up. I'll tell you what started it. My dad had a friend of his who was visiting us when we were living in Germany. He was a guy he'd met in Venezuela. They'd worked in an aluminum plant there. My dad enjoyed him on the job. And he had to come to Germany for a few months, and so he lived with our family. And the last day he was there, he didn't show up at night for dinner. The next morning, he comes in, and he is beat up. And my dad said, where you been? And he said, well, I'm getting ready to go home, so I decided to go down to the Reeperbahn. That's the red light district in Hamburg. So he went looking for a prostitute, and while he was there, he found one who took him to her place, slipped him a Mickey, and then had her pimp beat the crud out of him. And then he's saying to my dad, well, you know, I lost all my money. I missed my flight home. What do I do? My dad said, I have no sympathy for you at all. You're lucky you didn't get killed. And that would have been almost your fault. What do you think's going to happen when you do stuff like this? And I'm listening to that going, huh, I didn't see that coming, but he's kind of right, isn't he? I mean, that's just stupid. Why are you putting yourself in this horrible, immoral situation where you're vulnerable? But what if he'd been killed? Then he would have been a victim more than a, you know what I'm saying? He's a victim, but he's not a victim. And we run into these situations in life where, you know, gosh, I'll throw you one more just so you hear where I'm coming from on this. We had a gal in our church in Portland who came to talk to me, and she had been raped. But here's how she got raped. She's a married woman. She had a 2-year-old child. She went out to a bar, asked a man there to buy her drinks. At 2 a.m., she asked him to drive her home. And it turned out he was one of the 10 most wanted men in America. So I'm going, it's horrible she was raped. That was wrong. But at the same time, I'm going, what were you thinking? You know, why would you put yourself in such a vulnerable position? I mean, yes, nobody should rob you, but if you go down to a bad part of New York City with $100 bills sticking out of your pockets, it's likely to happen. So we need to create healthy boundaries for ourselves to keep ourselves safe, to be wise. But even then, as I was talking with her, I was trying to go, I don't want to blame her as a victim here. How do you deal with those situations? You hear what I'm saying? That's all I'm going to say on that part there. So when we look at this story, it really invites us to think about ourselves. We're sometimes in positions of power and authority. What do we do to create healthy and safe places for people to be in? Okay? In our homes, in our workplaces, are we creating, or here in our church, are we creating a healthy and safe place for people to be? And if something did happen, would we deal with it effectively and well? I hope we would. I believe we would. We also need to recognize that people are hurt and abused. Sometimes they're put in situations where maybe they should have made different decisions, but they're still hurt. And we have to name things as wrong and to go forward from there. But we also need to, as much as we can, flee sexual immorality. And, you know, it's a complicated thing when you start thinking through all these issues, isn't it? And then there's Joseph, now thrown in prison. You know, he is a person who did things pretty well, and his reward for that was slavery. Then he did things well again, and his reward for that was prison. And now we're going to hear where he goes next. Powerful to think about him trying to go forward from here.